We need to start shifting this week and talk about leadership and leadership development, strategies and structures. So that will be the focus of the time that we have together this week. Want to start by just briefly talking about the four tasks of a leader. We'll look again very briefly at four styles of leadership, and then to the kind of leaders that we need in a small group and how to get them. So, the four tasks of a leader, and I think that it's important that we realize that leaders do not have to be experts. They don't have to know everything about group dynamics. They don't have to have an in-depth background in the Bible. That leaders are ordinary people. And that when you ask, how do we find leaders in our church for small groups, that very often hidden behind a question like that is the assumption that there are only a very few people who are qualified to be leaders of small groups. That is a false, erroneous, dangerous, backwards assumption. Almost everyone can, with the right kind of support, structure, and encouragement, function as a small group leader in some type of small group. And if you can change your way of thinking to say, well, where are those few bright and shining stars that I can use as leaders, to a different assumption which says that almost all of God's people are capable of leadership in a small group setting, given the right kind of encouragement, support, structure, you'll find that you come at it entirely differently than when you work off the other assumption. What is it then that a leader has to do if a leader doesn't have to be an expert, a teacher, a know-it-all, the wisest person of all in the congregation? A leader has to pray. We talked about this the other day. The leader needs to be praying before the group meets by name for the group members. The leader should be in brief prayers during the group as things are happening in the group. When sometimes you have decisions about which way you ought to go or how to respond to something that has been said, the leader should be a person of prayer through the group experience. This will be silent prayer, not out loud praying, but prayer so that the process of the group is being permeated by prayer. And then after the group, particularly immediately after the group, to pray for what happens during our time together, for steps that people are making in faith, for problems that need to be worked on, to commit those to the Lord while they are still fresh in our minds, so that prayer is the first quintessential task of the leader. The second task is to prepare. And groups thrive and are strong when somebody is willing to prepare for the time together. The worst groups are the sloppiest groups, where people simply come in the room and say, well, here we are. Now what should we do? A leader is a person who is willing ahead of the meeting time to help get ready so that what happens when the people come together will be a quality experience. A couple of kinds of preparation. The preparation for physical arrangement. Now, notice that to prepare doesn't mean that the leader has to do all these things himself or herself. The leader could ask someone else to do this, hand this function over to another person, distribute the tasks that need to be accomplished, but there is a responsible person in the group to see to it that it's happening. Alongside a physical arrangement would include, is there anything that we need to have on hand in order to do the tasks that we have ahead of us? If it's Bible study, will everyone have a copy of the Bible? And here is an issue that I have increasingly resolved this way. We have so many versions of the Bible that when we come to study in a discussion Bible study together, and you have 17 versions represented with the 10 people because four of them are sitting there with 8 versions in columns alongside, it's quite possible for the group not to be able to focus in terms of where are we in the text and what are we talking about, because the phraseology will vary, particularly if some members of the group are using paraphrases like the Living Bible or those kinds of things. So that to strengthen what's going on, it's helpful if everyone can have a copy of the same version of the Bible. And for that reason, for instance, in our men's small groups, we use the Good News Bible, because you can buy it very inexpensively. The NIV is also available the same way. And you have a modern translation. And we say to people, you're welcome to look at your own versions, but so we'll all know where we are, we're going to look at the same version together. Occasionally, I'll Xerox off a passage if I don't have access to enough Bibles. But it's important that every person have a copy, because if people share, the tendency is that one person works in the text and the other person does not. Husbands and wives who say, oh, we'll look on together, usually one member of that partnership will be less active. The second part of preparation then is the discussion design. And a leader does need to have a plan of action. How are we going to get from here to there? And what is there? What do I want to accomplish in the time that we're going to have together? If we're doing a discipleship group or a covenant group and we're having sharing, Bible study, and prayer, how will we do the sharing? What sharing question will we use? How will we do the discussion? What questions will I ask? How will we do the prayer time? And how will I enable people to have a positive experience as we move into the prayer? If we have a task to do, what stage of the task are we in? You remember that there are steps in the problem-solving process? And if you're working in a task group, you ought to be thinking through the steps of the problem-solving process. Are you in an analysis of the problem stage? Are you in a brainstorming of alternative stage? Are you in an evaluating those alternatives? Where are you in the problem-solving process? And how do you want to help the group move through that step onto the next step so that the problems can be dealt with in a helpful kind of way? There needs to be a plan. Usually, if you have available discussion guides for a Bible study, for the average layperson to have some kind of written resource to work off of, can make more brief the preparation time. That's the great advantage of using resources that have already been written. If you have to develop your own resources, if each leader has to develop his or her own resources, then of course this preparation time is going to take a lot longer in order to do it. That's why resources are so helpful. 15 years ago, if you wanted to do discussion Bible studies, apart from InterVarsity and just a couple of the neighborhood Bible study guides, there was almost nothing available to help you get in and do a good job in discussing biblical kinds of material. Now, in the American market anyway, there are hundreds of things, most of which are listed on your bibliography, that you can use for resources. But it's important that leaders know that if they are using a pre-done or a pre-written guide, it is still going to take them approximately 2 hours to prepare to lead a small group meeting. There is no such thing of having a quality small group by simply walking in, opening the written resources, and start to read from the first line. Part of preparation is I work through the resources that I have. I decide which of these questions are going to be useful or not useful, which ones fit our group or don't fit our group, timing, how much time do I want to spend on each of these parts, and it's very unusual to need less than 2 hours to prepare. Let's suppose that you're using a Keith Miller, Bruce Larson cassette tape resource with Living the Adventure, The Edge of the Adventure, The Passionate People. It is still going to take you at least an hour, and again, more likely 2 hours to prepare, because you need to listen to the tape yourself. You need to read the chapter in the book that that tape is related to. You need to think through those questions and whether you want to reword those questions to fit your particular group better. So there's no such thing as a healthy small group that has no one willing to prepare. And people need to be told that if they're asked to be a leader, that one of the things we're asking them to do is to take some time to prepare. Now, this raises another issue. How many small groups can a leader be in? When you realize that any small group experience of 2 hours is going to take approximately 2 hours of preparation time to get ready for that, then you have already tied up the equivalent of 2 evenings on the part of those leaders. And you want to be very wise about what you're asking from those leaders. For most lay people, they should not be significantly involved in more than one small group. That's all they can handle. And if you are asking people to be involved in multiple small groups, you need to ask some other questions, like, what is this going to do to the marriage? What is happening with the children? Are they ever seeing their parents? What is happening in terms of the rest of this person's life? What demand level, is this realistic in terms of what we are asking for from people? For most people, one small group in a week is asking a lot on top of their full-time work kind of thing, their worship commitments, and other commitments that they may have in their life. Now, I will come to the issue, I'll deal with it right now. One of the most common patterns suggested for small group leaders is that they meet together as a team of leaders once a week, and then they have their own small group once a week. What I would like to suggest to you is that in the early stages of a group, that may work for a while as a training model, encouragement model, and those kinds of things. But as a permanent model, to ask people to be together in two small groups in a week, to which they have a major responsibility, is asking for too much. It is not a good permanent model to expect leaders to make that kind of commitment. You're taking too much away from the other things that they're supposed to be doing. And if you have any concerns about their witness in the world and other kinds of things, you don't want to tie them up, you know, in meeting after meeting after meeting. So that's not a good permanent model. There's one other dynamic. For a small group to be maximally healthy, it needs to experience cohesion, trust, commitment, self-disclosure. It is difficult for most of us to really bond and disclose and give ourselves and make commitments to each other in more than one primary group. I can do that with one group of people. Most of us, there are exceptions, but most of us do not do that with more than one group of people. To do that with 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people is quite a bit. And if you put me in another group and ask me to make the same intensity of commitment in the other group, so now you're asking me to be involved in an in-depth level with 20 people instead of 10 people, most people can't handle that. So what happens is they form a primary loyalty to one group or the other. And if you're not careful, the primary loyalty will be to the leader's group rather than bonding with the people that they are serving in their other small groups. And you want the primary loyalty to be in that small group that they are working with, and the secondary loyalty to be to the leader's group after you get past the initial stage. Discussion design. Well, you're going to need a plan, and as part of that plan, then you need a time plan. How are we going to use the time that we have available? If we have an hour and a half, how many minutes are we going to spend on the introduction? When are we really going to start? Our true starting time and our true closing time are two important issues. If our true starting time is 15 minutes later than we actually said, do I have 15 extra minutes on the other end of it, or do I really only have an hour and 15 minutes to work with in terms of planning what I'm going to do? Many people never get honest about the true starting time, and they have a plan then that takes the full time, but they don't have the full time available. So they run late every week, or they don't get to the last element in their small group design every week because they haven't realistically thought about how much time do I actually have to work with. Typical pattern that helps with this is to say, if the group meets from 7:30 to 9:30, is that we start gathering at 7:15 and the group discussion begins at 7:30, so that people know that it's all right to come, have refreshments, visit with each other, but that we actually start the group meeting time at 7:30. If you say the group starts at 7:30, in most people's heads, that group doesn't start until 7:45. They start arriving at 7:30, and in our culture, give or take 10 or 15 minutes, you're not late. People do not arrive on the dot at something. So it's helpful to clarify what's our true starting time and what's your true closing time. And here it's important to be legalistic. Groups should not be allowed to go over time. I'll make that a flat-footed statement. If the tongues of Pentecost are descending and your group agrees that it would end at 9:30, it's important to end at 9:30. The way you handle it, if there's fantastic stuff going on, is you say, our time is up. Let's stand up and take a break. Anyone who needs to leave, free to go home. And if anyone wants to stay around, you're free to stay around. But you don't stay in your tight little circle and say, if anybody wants to leave, feel free. It takes a lot of courage to get up and walk out under those kinds of conditions. You want to respect the contract. There are lots of lay people that if you run late, even though you're having a wonderful time, the next week they will think very seriously about that and decide they got babysitting problems, they got tired problems, and they just can't afford to be out as late. Your group was supposed to be over at 9:30, but they never get home before 11, and they can't afford not to get home before 11. So keep faith, and this which means then a time plan. If you don't plan it out, you're not going to be able to do the things that you want to accomplish in the time that's available. So the leader needs to pray. The leader needs to prepare. Then the third task of a leader is to guide the group during its time together. And again, the leader may hand over all the functions to other people. The leader doesn't necessarily have to do all of this stuff herself or himself, but it does need to be done. I am a firm believer that there is no such thing as a leaderless group, and that if you have a leaderless group, the most dominant person in the group will take the group over, or the group will simply drift and not have a very satisfying experience. You do need a guide during the group meeting who is helping the group to move through to accomplish its purpose. So you need a guide during the discussion. You need a guide in terms of communication skills. You need a guide in terms of problem solving. Now, let me mention one other word that would go with this. And that is that the guide only needs to intervene when people are getting off the track. As long as people are going down the trail in the right direction, if you have a tour guide on a trip, if you make a trip overseas and you have a tour guide, if everyone's going along, you know, you don't need to be intervening all the time. Let them go. But if it looks as if they're going to lose it, if it looks as if they're just wandering around and they're not getting anywhere and they're not making any forward progress, then somebody needs to intervene and say, maybe we've talked about that long enough and we need to go on to the next thing. Someone needs to hold the group accountable to the time. And again, time is not a legalistic thing. Let me give you an example of a small group from this class last year. Most of the guys in the group had beeping watches. They knew that they needed to plan time in their groups, and so they set their beeping watches to allow for 20 minutes for sharing, 40 minutes for Bible study, you know, 10 minutes for prayer, and 15 minutes for process observation. And their watches, must have taken them 9 years just to set all these little knobs, their watches would go beep, beep, beep. Well, when you run off of that rigid a sense of time, you can really inhibit what the Spirit is doing. And I was observing in a group, and a guy was just pouring it out, and it was important stuff, very important to him, and three watches went beep, beep, beep. And someone said, go ahead. And he said, oh, no, yeah, we need to go on to the next thing. And it aborted the process. Time is to be a general guide, you know, that you have in mind, you know, to help direct where you're going, but it's not to be a legalistic. Have I just touched the nerve? Somebody's watched your speech. It's not to be a legalistic master of what's going on in the group. So guiding is a ministry of sensitivity. We want forward movement. We intervene only when we have to. So it isn't an issue of dominating. It isn't an issue of talking all the time. It isn't an issue of holding people rigidly to rules. You know, but it is a sensitive process of guidance. And then the fourth function of a leader, the fourth task of a leader, is the ministry of care. And I think of that in several different ways. One is the projection of personal warmth, that the leader does need to convey to people that I'm glad you're here, and I look forward to seeing you. The one kind of person who should never be a small group leader is a person who is so hostile to people, so reclusive, so unable to look them in the eye, that the message that comes across is, you know, I don't like you, I wish you weren't here, and I'm sorry we're doing this. You know, there does need to be some personal warmth which is conveyed, because that's the river on which care is done. Then there is a caring task of protecting the needy in that small group. And we talked last week about the person who is in need of help from outside the group. But also there is a ministry of sensitivity to the person who's the most vulnerable in the group. It may be that it's a sensitivity to the non-Christian who is present in the group, or to the person who is in a particular struggle of faith, or to the person who's hurting in a relationship crisis of some kind, or they're just vulnerable in a particular way. And sometimes a group will be fairly thoughtless and not know what they're doing when they're just kind of tramping around on territory, and you may be aware that there needs to be a little more care, sensitivity being exercised there. So the protection of the needy. When someone says something off the wall and the whole group jumps on them, or labels them, or makes fun of them, then the leader needs to come in and be on the side of or with the vulnerable person so that they are alongside. One of the images that I have in this is Jesus with the woman caught in adultery. And there are those Pharisees, those men standing around, you know, ready to have her condemned, hoping, you know, for that, trying to trap Jesus. And Jesus' identification is not with them, you know, but with the vulnerable woman in that particular situation. It does not mean he approves of what she has done. And sometimes the leader finds himself, herself, protecting the vulnerable person, not because you agree with where they're coming from, theologically or what they're saying, but because they are standing in that particular place of need and you want to be of help to them in that spot. The basic thing that you're doing is modeling, providing an example in the small group, a demonstration of what it means to act in love towards each other. As I see the primary ministry of a small group leader, it is to be a servant of the group. That the small group leader needs to be a person who does not ask only the question, what's in this for me? But who is willing to say, how can I make myself available for the well-being, the upbuilding, the encouragement, the functioning of the other members of this small group. If a small group is composed only of persons who ask, what's in this for me, and that's the only question they ask, that small group will not become a healthy Christian community. But it only takes one servant in the middle of a small group who brings an attitude of servant love, who is willing to think about and pray about and be available for the well-being of the other people. And that is contagious stuff. If you have a person like that in a small group, the others catch it. They see it in action. And they themselves begin modeling those kinds of behaviors. And they are changed because there is a person like this in the middle. That the power of the servant leader in the small group is very large. Yeah. I know there are discussions about strong leaders in terms of churches, you know, with out of the church growth movement and this kind of thing. And there are different issues at stake there. But in the small group, there isn't any question, but what the small group needs is a facilitating, enabling servant leader. If that is there, the group will be healthy, even if lots of other things are missing. Then that takes me to the four styles of leadership. You have a chart on this in the syllabus, 73A and B. Okay? It's actually A, 73A. but just to apply this material to your kinds of small groups. Autocratic leadership, authoritative leadership, democratic leadership, and laissez-faire leadership. Let's translate those into tell, self, participate, and delegate. See? The four styles of leadership that were talked about in your Johnson & Johnson textbook. The telling leader is the one who makes all the decisions and announces them. The selling leader is the one who makes the decision but basically cares about how other people are going to respond and so tries to deal with their questions and their concerns. They're selling. The participatory leader is one who is interactive in terms of decision making and allows other people to shape the decisions as they are being made. The delegating leader is one who basically says, you do it. I give you permission. And in different kinds of circumstances, each of those types of leadership styles may be appropriate. But when you move to the small group, there are some very definite things, and not all styles of leadership are as appropriate in the small group setting. The autocratic or the telling kind of style is one where the leader exercises total control of what is going on. The leader decides the contract. The leader announces the contract. The leader asks and answers all questions. It's hilarious. In a sharing time with an autocratic leader, the leader will say, does anybody have anything to share? And proceed to spend the next 20 minutes talking about what he has to share. The leader says, let's pray. And by that, the leader means, you listen while I pray. The leader asks the questions for the Bible study and then proceeds to answer all the questions for the Bible study. I could not draw this too extreme because I have seen this happen in group after group after group. This is not the kind of leadership that makes for healthy small groups. It puts a lid on the members. It doesn't enable the functioning of all of the members of the group. And in time, it either creates passive dependent members, which is unhealthy spiritually, or hostile and resistant members who may just walk out of the group and not come back, or who may actually get in a lot of conflict inside the group. But autocratic is never a suitable leadership style for small group ministry. Then you move to the other extreme and look at laissez-faire, if you would. Again, laissez-faire, meaning each one do your own thing or let them be. It's a permissive and passive style of leadership, and typically the way I see this with the pastors and young life leaders and intervarsity types or whatever is, a laissez-faire leader will come to a group meeting time and say, anybody got anything to share? That's the last thing the leader says. Let's log in. And that's the last thing the leader says. There was no planning. There is no time plan. There is no purpose that we're working toward except anything that happens to emerge in this process. When you have got a very mature group who know exactly what they're doing, and they have a strong sense of purpose, every one of them, laissez-faire can work. But even in that kind of group, most of the time, over time, it will lead to flat, boring, static kinds of group experiences. I sat in one group for a year with a guy who said, for 1 year, let's log in. And the sharing was absolutely predictable because people would share the same kinds of things. If he had done some thinking and praying and planning about how to help us share different parts of our personality or different aspects of our ministry or different things we were working on with the Lord, but no, it was just let's log in. So we got the same kind of material all the time, and it was not helpful. So even in very mature groups, this is quite a cop-out. But in the average small group in a church, this is fatal. If you have a passive style in which there is almost no control of what's going on in the typical conservative small church, and even in the more liberal ones, what will tend to happen is the most obnoxious person will take over the functional leadership of the group. So those are the two patterns, autocratic and laissez-faire, which I do not recommend as the regular patterns for groups. Never autocratic, very seldom laissez-faire. Where we're going to live our lives with small group leadership is in the ballpark between authoritative and democratic. And authoritative is a category that I've invented. This does not exist in the literature. The literature of small groups always talks about democratic styles of small group functioning, which means group-centered, with shared control, with the leader and the members sharing functioning and decisions. And the sense that you have here is we are a community of equals, and everybody's opinion, decision counts with the same weight as everyone else's. I looked at that out of my secular small group training for a lot of long time, and then I realized that isn't how it happens in churches. That in churches we don't function democratically. The church is not a democracy. Our goal is shared functions because the church is a community in which every single person has a gift, has a contribution, has a function to perform. So then I started thinking about what actually does happen in small groups in churches, and I came up with this category of authoritative moving to the democratic. Authoritative is strong control where the leader or leadership partners, remember we talked about trying to have two always, if possible, so you have shared leadership, but the leaders have a definite idea of what they want to do and where they want to go. They don't come to the first meeting and say, let's vote on it. They do come to the first meeting with a pretty definite idea that we ought to be doing this, this, this. They talked that over with other people. They were open to influence, but having reached some conclusions on it, it's really fairly non-negotiable. When you come and you're organizing a small group program for your church, and you are training leaders, and you invite all the members of your church to get involved in the small group, you're really not starting with a democratic pattern where once you get them all in the front room, you have them sit there and say, now what shall we do in our small group? That's not really what you're doing. You really do have a definite idea. The leader brings expectations and a plan and a way of proceeding into that process. But unlike the autocratic leader, this person has a definite plan but is open to modification, is willing to be responsive to the members, listen seriously to what other people are saying, attempt to get them active and involved. I've used the language of handing the functions away, right? That anything a leader can give to somebody else to do, the leader should give it. The easiest things to give away are refreshments, the home, the physical arrangements, bringing the Bible, but you can give all of those tasks away. Yeah. Any leader who does all of that stuff himself or herself is foolish, because this is one of the ways that you start to have the group be owned by everyone that is there. After you get past that level, that's easy. Anyone can give away those functions. Then you start looking at some other kinds of functions. Let's suppose that it's summarizing. Some leaders believe that the essence of leadership is they will summarize everything that's been said. So every person that makes a statement, they repeat it and summarize it. And they're always having the last word. A wise leader knows that summarizing is a function someone else can do. And I might say, Judy, would you listen over the next couple of minutes? And when it comes time, would you summarize for us what it is that we've been saying? I just handed a function over. And then Judy will perform the function of summarizing. And then I don't re-summarize what Judy says. All functions like that can be given away. And the authoritative leader gives away every function that can be given away that will be picked up by people and performs those functions which no one else will perform. And there always are some. The leader's gifts and functions is necessary in the group. Not everything will be able to be picked up by everyone that is there, but lots of it can be. So, authoritative leader has a plan, knows where he wants to go, is open, and actively seeking the involvement of other people, models good communication skills. It's not at all uncommon in a typical small group for the leader to be the only person who asks anyone for information or opinion, the only person who practices active listening in a good kind of way. Yeah. So models that kind of behavior, but uses personal power to empower others. This is very important. I've never seen this in the writing anywhere, and yet I see this, as I have worked in groups over the years, as one of the most important things. That it's on your chart, item 7, uses personal power to empower others, asking others to take on functions. So the leader does have power. does have strength. The philosophy underneath this is, I don't deny that I have power. See, laissez-faire ignores the fact that I have power. And is irresponsible about that. But authoritative leadership says, yes, the leader does have power and influence, but the leader is going to use her power and influence in order to empower other people. So as I see the way it actually works in churches, is that churches start as the first week of a small group. When you've done contracting and invited people to come, etc., you are using a model in new groups particularly of authoritative leadership with the goal that by the time you move to the end of the first contract period, you have a democratic style of functioning so that you can say to the group, what do you want to do? And the group decides. How do you want to handle the leadership? And the group decides. What's our purpose in the next contract period? And the group decides. It may not happen in the first contract period with an excessively dependent group in a church in which people have never been encouraged to do any thinking or be involved for themselves, but for sure by the end of the second contract period, you ought to be able to trust the group then to share the function, share control, function with integrity, you know, working with this kind of model. Church facility versus the home. Most of the time, the home is where you want to be. The church facility sends some kinds of messages, and it encourages churchy behavior. I put on my church clothes, I put on my church manners, and I come to church. And what you're trying to encourage is the integration of Christian faith into all of life, and to be in the home is a major step forward in that process. The other thing is that the patterns in the church building tend to run towards formal leadership and upfront leadership and teaching styles and all of those kinds of things, and moving into a home helps you when your pattern is equalized participation and this low-key type of leadership that we're talking about here. A third argument for being in the home is in terms of evangelism. There are many more people who will come when they are invited to come into a home in a personal, relational kind of invitation than coming to a church building or to a church program. And we have a parent ed program in our church, and I was surprised to discover for how many of those non-Christian couples, young couples, going into a church building was a very frightening thing for them to do, or a very negative thing for them to do. They had a whole lot of feelings that were attached to sanctuary that they had to deal with. When you invite them into a home, you just shortcut all of that kind of stuff. And homes are relationship centers. Church buildings are program centers. So when you move into a home, you're just in a relational context automatically. So most of the time, you want to meet in a home, wherever possible. I follow this to such an extent in my own ministry that I have all my committee meetings in homes. I find that simply to move the committee into a home changes the way in which we relate to each other, that we relate beyond roles and more as persons when we're in a home setting than when we come to a church kind of setting. The exceptions are if you certain kinds of programs you will start in the church and do them that way. There are some people in traditional churches that have never done anything in a home, and you're going to have to start small groups in the church to get them used to small groups before you try to transfer them into other settings. But there is one basic requirement. If you're going to do small groups in a church building, you need a room which is as much like a front room in a home as possible. It needs to be comfortable, pleasant to be in, adult-oriented, and quite honestly, you know this, most churches smell because they are closed up, you know, a large amount of the time, and you may not be aware of the extent to which that building sends messages all of the time. And to move people out into homes, you just don't even have to deal, you know, with that kind of thing. Some homes smell too. Babies and diapers and dogs and all of that type of thing. This is the thing I really wanted you to see. Now, leaders who know what they're doing and where they're going, they do have a plan. You know, they're not afraid to move forward in terms of the plan, but they know that their goal is to have all of the group members fully functioning as fast as possible, and that they need to be deliberate and intentional about handing those kinds of functions over to group members. And That is not the easiest thing to do, but it is very, very doable. Which leads me then just to underscore something you know, and that is, whose group is this? Who does the group belong to? The group belongs to all of the members of the group. And every one of those members is needed for the healthy functioning of a small group. The group is not the leader's possession. The group belongs to all of the members. And the leader basically then is there to enable all of those members to use their gifts to function as best they can so that we have shared ownership in what's going on in the group. All right, leadership development. Now I want to move and talk about the kinds of leaders you need in a church program. We're moving our way towards programs and some of those kinds of issues. Basically, you will find as you are strategizing for a church that you need four different kinds of leaders. All of these need to be people who know how to pray, prepare, guide, and care, but they will function on these different levels. The first one is the person who is a facilitator. There is nothing sacred about this vocabulary, but I'm using it to try and indicate the type of leader I'm looking at. A facilitator is a person who can function within a clearly designed program structure, for whom there are good resources available that do not need adaptation by the leader. They will work as is. And the program design is very clear. Let's suppose you are using Living the Adventure. Some of you have done that. Who's done that in here? Yeah. And you're using that particular model. It's clear, it's simple, the resources work the way they're laid out. The leader that you need for that needs to know how to pray and prepare and guide and care, but the leader doesn't have to understand a whole lot about group dynamics. You know, they basically can work the program. If you develop good programs with good resources, you know, the vast majority of your people, I'll pick a number out of the air, 90% of your people can function as this kind of leader. Yeah. The more complex, ambiguous, and needful of personal decision-making on the part of the leader, the more training the leader needs. But the facilitator who's going to work with a clearly defined program in a well-laid-out structure can get by with minimal training. You have to have some training, but it doesn't take as much training to pull this off. The next level up is what I call the gifted enabler. And again, the language is not sacred. But this is a person who can function with structural flexibility, which means they could take the edge of adventure, and after that was over, they could lead the group in a discussion Bible study, and after that was over, they could use Church is Alive material on relationships, and after that was over, they could do something else. They don't simply know how to work one plan and pattern. They understand small groups enough, the purposes of small groups, the dynamics of small groups, that they are flexible and they can do more than one kind of thing. In the long run, this is the kind of leader that you want to train for, because small groups over time should change. And you're not just working a program, you're building community. But gifted enablers who know how to function in diverse kinds of small group settings and know how to work with groups as groups grow and change their contracts, yep, need strong training. You do not get these kinds of leaders out of a minimal training kind of a model. They need to know more. They need to have more background, more input, more resources. But they're worth their weight in gold. And what you want to do is start building a training model so that you will produce this kind of leader. This kind of person you can use, but you have to retrain them over and over and over again. Every time you have a new program, you have to go back and give them a new shot in the arm. This kind of leader can stay in a small group and grow with that small group over time, and you don't have to retrain them all the time. They know how to move with where the small group is going. The next level of leadership that you will need in any church once you get more than three small groups is you will need a small group coordinator. And this is a person who functions within one small group. You should never have a small group coordinator who is not in a small group himself or herself, but who works to support, encourage, and resource the small groups that exist. So when you begin to have multiple small groups, you find that every small group leader needs to be support and encouraged. And as those groups are moving along in their life cycle, they need new resources. They may need problem solving. They need to know about new people coming in or out of the small group. So that as the number of groups that you have grow, you are going to need persons who are able to work with those various small groups. Let's suppose that you begin couple small groups. When you only have one or two couple small groups, and that's all you have going on in your church, you as a pastor or an elder or a staff person can work with those few groups. But let's suppose that you have six or seven of those small groups, and you want to get a singles group going. As soon as you find your numbers of groups growing and the types of groups changing, you will need a coordinator to stay very close to what is happening in each type of small group that you have going. Knowing that you're going to need small group coordinators, when you choose your training models, you want to use training models out of which some small group coordinators have the possibility of emerging. And if you only use minimal training models, you will never get small group coordinators who know what they're doing. So you need a strong training model in order to get small group coordinators. Now, there are two kinds of functions that coordinators can perform, and low level and more complex level. The lowest level is that the person serves as a switchboard. Do you know that image? A communications center. So that everyone who wants to know anything about small groups can call the small group coordinator. And there is a person who has the information, has his hands on the resources, knows how to answer questions, knows where to go for help. The staff may relating to the coordinator. Coordinators are usually lay people. I want to say always lay people. So that the coordinator can be an interface between the small group and the staff if you have a multiple staff, or even in a smaller church if you have numbers of small groups. So switchboard kinds of functions. That a person can do switchboard and communication with very little training, and this is how you get started, is you use people who don't have much background because that's where you have to begin. But in time, you want them to be problem solvers. And problem solvers need to understand what's going on or they'll do more damage than help. As they're interacting with each of these small groups. So in the long run, you want the coordinator to have as much training as possible. The fourth level of small group leadership in a congregation is to have the strategist and trainer. And this is a person who knows how to build structure and how to create things that do not already exist. A person who has some vision for what is possible in small groups and is responsive to the Spirit and is able then to bring other people along so that they can see where they fit and how they plug into the structure. This is what you should be, strategists and trainers. If you are in a very large church, those of you who are in congregations of over 1,000, 2,000, 4,000, 6,000, if you're in a very large church, you will need some other strategists and trainers in time who will be able to share this ministry of leadership training with you. In a smaller kind of church, this is the pastor or a key lay person who takes on this particular kind of role. But this person isn't doing small groups out of their back pocket. This has a front and center crucial role for them. This is something they are putting time and energy into because you don't create and you don't build new structures and you don't make the structures responsive in an ongoing kind of way without putting major kinds of attention into what is going on there. Most churches are not as successful as they should be in small group things because what they're looking for are programs that they can use the lowest level of leadership development in. And that doesn't give them the kinds of leaders they're going to need for the ongoing permanent health of small groups in the congregation. Once you have multiple levels of small groups, then you need these higher developed levels of leadership. It's not at all uncommon that people have been in the facilitator type of function before they get into the structured structural flexibility kind of function before they ever become coordinators, and for sure before they become trainers. So they do tend to be the kinds of experiences. And that's one way to increase your leadership pool, by the way. You do lots of experiences where people can practice being leaders in simple structures. And that doesn't cost you a lot in training, et cetera. So you give lots of that because people need those building blocks. And then you do things which call for higher levels of training and more understanding what's going on. And then you move to the next stages as you're going along. You're not going to train trainers who have never done anything in a small group in a clearly designed program. At least that's how I see it. It's that you need those building blocks if you want permanent leadership. What I see is that as we have these levels of programming, that in fact these types of people emerge more, you know, from those levels. I have decided for myself that strategy is the missing gift in the church, that very few seem to have any gift for strategy, but I've wrestled with this. I believe strategy can be taught, and that we haven't taught people how to think strategically. I do believe it is a gift, you know, and it comes to some people naturally. But we haven't taught people to think strategically. We keep plugging them into programs, so there's a whole domain that they never get stretched in. And that democratic small groups, for instance, when you start asking people, what is our purpose, working on contracting and covenanting, you are teaching people how to be strategic. When you work that particular model of small group healthily, you know, over time, you have more chance of strategists and trainers developing than when you do dominant small groups with leaders who basically are settling everything and the members are never getting a chance to really wrestle through purpose issues, for instance. Large numbers of churches where the lay people are never asked purpose questions. What do you believe God wants this group of people to do? They always buy purposes. They never have to evolve purposes or wrestle through purposes. So I think they're parts of the brain that just never get exercised, and strategy is part of that.